There is no final arbiter on belonging. No one is going to welcome you into the room, and no one is going to validate whether you belong to be there in the first place. That is the key with imposter syndrome. It is a feedback loop. Matt, in the history of Shark Tank, no one has walked on this set like you did and act like you were there from day one.
Why is developing self-awareness so important?
When something happens to you that you can't control in your life, that everyone can see, it forces you to reframe your entire identity to go a little bit deeper. And I think the way you cultivate self-awareness is by modeling vulnerability.
When it comes to managing your emotions when you have to perform, how do you compartmentalize?
Regulating your emotions is a huge key to success. And people who cannot regulate their emotions professionally end up having a ceiling on their career.
Today, we're talking about what it means to go all in and eliminate plan B. We're also going to talk about what it means to have immense self-awareness, handle pressure, and enjoy the pursuit of the thing. From high school dropout to Fordham Law graduate and now a Harvard fellow, please welcome the co-founder of RSC Ventures, which is invested in companies like Resy, VaynerX, Magnolia Bakery, and the author of the Wall Street Journal bestseller Burn the Boats and oh so much more, Mr. Matt Higgins. How are you today, sir?
I'm great. Love that intro. I like listening to your voice. It's very smooth and hypnotic.
I appreciate that. Well, I mean, I think an opportune place to start, and this is something I've been meaning to ask you since reading your book, coming across your content, learning about your background, is imposter syndrome. How do you deal with imposter syndrome?
Yeah. In the book, I talk about a story that's cringy that I meditated a lot whether to share it, which was going on Shark Tank. I was a guest on Shark Tank, for those who don't know. And when you gave a preview of my humble beginnings, but anyone who's grown up in poverty and dysfunction, like, you have all these legacy shame issues, like, which fork do I use? So why are there many of them at the table? You know, like, no refinement, you know? And one of those legacy issues is honestly always feeling a degree to which you're walking into rooms that you don't feel prepared for. I remember being a kid and I remember my friend's parents kind of made a joke about how I was like sloppy, you know, because I had like dirty clothes as like this little, you know, random kid selling flowers on street corners. And so that always stuck with me for my whole life. The point of that is when you come from places like that, you're often walking into rooms that are a reach and that you have no conditioning for, right? And Shark Tank, it all came out when I went on that show. It just felt like I was taking a unmitigated risk by stepping out so publicly, hadn't been on TV, had sort of been below the radar. And I share the story in the book about how I lost my mind the day before. I never sleep anyway, but I really didn't sleep. And how I listened to Lose Yourself on a Loop to get my head together. And Damon John was the one person I felt I could confide in. We grew up not far from each other in Queens. And, you know, he came up from humble beginnings. He's black, I'm white, but we both worked. He worked at Red Lobster. I worked at McDonald's. And so I pull him aside and I tell him the truth about how I'm feeling. And he says this most amazing line that's like, you know, I always say it's like Socrates. He said, after cursing everyone else out and saying that, you know, what we had to do to get here. He goes, Matt, you belong here because you are here. And what I loved about that statement is that there is no final arbiter on belonging. No one is going to welcome you into the room and no one is going to validate whether you belong to be there in the first place. You will just be there and it'll have been like you were always there. And when I finished my first appearance on Shark Tank, Lori Grenier, who's like the den mother of the guest sharks, she turns to me and she's like, you know, Matt, and I talk about this in the book as well. She goes, Matt, in the history of Shark Tank, no one has walked on this set like you did and act like you were there from day one. And I thought, what an incredible juxtaposition. If only she knew and the rest of these people knew that I was freaked out so much so that I was going to pretend I had food poisoning the night before and call Rohan Oza, who's a guest shark, and be like, dude, man, I'm out. And so I share that cringy story in the book, and I'm getting to the point, to one, show that we all suffer with imposter syndrome. Two, no one is ever going to validate whether you belong in a room or not. It's entirely upon you. But three, most importantly, after I finished Shark Tank, I had this moment of melancholy of being like, wow, that was really hard. I can't imagine what would be more uncomfortable. And then I was sad that I couldn't think of something more painful interestingly. And I realized that is the key with imposter syndrome. It is a feedback loop. It is your mind letting you know, I have no neural pathways for what we're about to do here. And I am uncomfortable in unfamiliar territory. And really, it's just growth happening. Again, master of the obvious. Of course, it is what that is. But once you let that sink in, when you experience imposter syndrome, you realize, one, it's a feedback loop, but two, consider the alternative, a life of mediocrity, where I'm never creating those new neural pathways, never laying down new tracks, and instead I'm just doing the same thing over and over again. That to me is more soul crushing and killing than freaking out on the first time on the set of Shark Tank. So when I did, and I'll stop here, but when I was teaching at Harvard Business School, I had Kim Kardashian come in as a guest lecturer. We had the most amazing conversation that they captured on camera with Kim talking about when we first called her to come. She's like, me? Like, I think you have the wrong person. For those who don't know who would like to hate on her, by the way, I have just one number for you. It is $4 billion. That is the valuation of the company that she has built from scratch. And yet Kim felt imposter syndrome. So I love this topic. I decided to share about it in my book so I could be a little more open about it. Stop there.
I love the feedback, especially someone who, and I referred to it at the top of Titan, hearing people who have established themselves, and as I outline, you outline, and we'll continue to discuss, humble beginnings on your end. There's a lot of reasons to doubt whether you belong in a room, but like you said, no one gets to make that decision. I feel like once you embrace that mentality, you could start to really take steps into who you are. And one of the bedrock principles of taking steps into the vision, this is a concept that I hold dear, I know you hold dear as well, is immense self-awareness. I'd love for the audience to get your feedback on why is developing self-awareness so important?
Yeah, and just to finish the thought about your point about the unlock of when you begin to see imposter syndrome that way, it's so profound and transformative because it gives you language to articulate the suffering you're feeling, because you could interpret the suffering in two very different ways. One, confirmation that you're a fucking fraud. Am I allowed to curse? Number two, confirmation that you're pulling and reaching outside your comfort zone. And once you have language, you will settle on the latter, not the former. The former will destroy your life and the latter will unleash you. So self-awareness, why I think that's so important is because when I look at people, well, what do you attribute your success to? And, you know, was there kind of a moment? And I would say that my moment is when life brought me to my knees, a combination of having cancer and then ultimately getting divorced. And when you're somebody who's defined your whole life as doing things a little bit early, I went to college early, I was successful early, first this, first that, when something happens to you that you can't control in your life, that everyone can see, it forces you to reframe your entire identity. So I had went from being somebody who was very successful to somebody who has a failed marriage, in his 30s. That's not how I drew up the plan, right? And there was no mistaking it. There's no putting a sunny Instagram post upon, on this life experience, combined with testicular cancer when I lost my testicle, which is all about male identity, right? And I was, am I going to be infertile, forever? Like, am I going to have an erection? Like, these are some serious emasculating experiences. So it brought me to my knees, and what it forced me to do is scrutinize all these patterns of behavior that I had been ignoring and thought I had overcome because I was trying to put up this front. And once that front had been decimated, this manifestation of me was no longer a successful person, but as walking wounded. And I realized everything was still okay. I kind of changed my focus to be external to internal and started to attack things. An example being, I have been running from the boogeyman since the time I was 9 years old. This sort of feeling that my mother was going to die in that room next door and we have nothing to eat and I hate this existence and where's there a man who's going to save us? Like, there's been a boogeyman over my shoulder long after I was safe financially. The zeros in the bank account didn't do anything to make the boogeyman go away. And when life brought me to my knees, I was like, I need to stop acting on cortisol and a stress response, which is a trauma response, probably called complex PTSD. And I need to deal with those demons so that I can go to another level. So that's my personal journey with self-awareness. But the reason why I'm so passionate about it is I saw how it unlocked my potential as a manager, but also as a human being. I would ascribe most of my wealth and everything else to that that looking inward rather than looking externally. So the question I get asked, I'd love to talk to you about it, is, okay, that's all great, Matt. Self-awareness is a catchphrase. Now we all talk about it, but how do you create environments that cultivate self-awareness? Mm. How do you mentor other people? And my simple way of doing it, we're doing it now. I just shared to you my testicle being cut off. Was I going to be, could I get an erection? Was I going to be infertile? Like, that's some like pretty cringy personal stuff, right?
Yeah.
But now somebody listening to this, whatever it is that you're afraid to reveal, if you believe what I just revealed is more comfortable than what you're afraid of, you now have permission to go a little bit deeper. And I think the way you cultivate self-awareness is by modeling vulnerability. When you model vulnerability, the person that's listening to you that's been hiding something is like, huh, oh, and first of all, that's pretty embarrassing. Maybe they judge you a little bit, which I love when people judge me. Like, go judge me. Now go heal thyself. So anyway, we could talk all day about it, but the book for me is one big exercise in modeling vulnerability to cultivate self-awareness in the reader.
I love that you brought it all together through vulnerability. If you don't know what you stand for, then you can't really add value to anyone or anything. And having that self-awareness around where your blind spots are and then making them strengths, like, you can't use this against me because I already know what my weaknesses are. So go ahead, give it your best shot. And on one side, I feel like there's this old school mentality where we got to hide all these things and not let anybody know. And social media these days is kind of trending around this, oh, share all your weakest moments and, you know, your vulnerabilities, and that'll draw in followers. And I feel like that's also because people love drama, and it's kind of this tricky line where if you share too much, it could be held against you in employment, it could be held against you socially. Well, maybe that job isn't for you, maybe those people that are judging you aren't for you, and you get to go find your people in the right situation that actually may be best for you. So to hear someone of your stature and caliber, having gone through what you've been through mentally, physically, and emotionally, to still persevere and to use yourself as that example, it's commendable.
Well, thank you. Well, I love what you just said about social media. Let's dive into that for a second, because I actually think there's a false narrative that's perpetuated under the guise of vulnerability because it's good clickbait. But the reality, think about the way it's packaged. It's always packaged as, I went through something, I stumbled, but I overcame it. I'm good now, and I shall share with you how I'm good. It must always be in the rear view mirror. And that's a lie, actually. To be human is to progress and regress. I wrote my book as an accountability partner, because I can't even follow the headline half the time, but I try nonetheless. And I got a tattoo, like a gang sleeve, down my right arm. It says burn the boats in Chinese. So when I look in the mirror, I'm like, listen, you hypocrite, you're the guy who wrote the book, commit. And so it bothers me so much. It's the connective tissue of all these posts and all these self-anointed gurus is to act like whatever it is that they dealt with is in the rearview mirror because they don't want to pull it forward. And the reason why I shared the Shark Tank story, I actually don't see other guest sharks ever talk about imposter syndrome or they didn't feel ready for primetime. And I know that's not true because I get the phone calls. And so I think if you really want to do a service in the universe when you're successful, is show how you're successful in spite of, not because of, in spite of the baggage you still carry, your unreconciled mom issues, whatever they are, rather than, I'm here because I'm such a good communicator and I'm wealthy now. You should emulate me. And now maybe that's because I'm just maladjusted and I'm trying to assume everyone else is. My wife is the most wonderfully adjusted human being, so she might be the exception to this. But I suspect most of us are still struggling every day with regression, with setting goals, and you can't stick to them and you commit, but you can't implement it. I wrote Burn the Boats because it doesn't come naturally to me. And it's almost like an inside joke. Normally this phrase is used by people who are bombastic. Sometimes it shows up in the right wing too. And I used it actually to appropriate the idea of a boat as a metaphor for all the things that beckon us to retreat. Mm-hmm. My boat is not jingoistic or militaristic. My boat is a metaphor for anxiety, shame, all the things that make it hard to show up in the world and fully commit. And then I provide 50 different case studies of really high prominent people who I have some degree of intimacy with, where they let me share those things that held them back. One of my favorite stories in the book, and for the reader, for those out there who haven't read it, this will illustrate how I'm using the phrase. And again, it's not like pedantic or prescriptive. It's more, you know, you have to circumnavigate the globe to end up at the point of the book. Rex Ryan was a coach of the Jets, my good friend, who I love to death, and most entertaining coach I ever worked with. And I was running the business of the team. We hired him. And we had this scandal, which back then was a scandal. Now it'd be absurd because it would be on OnlyFans, you know what I mean? Like, but back then, Rex was, you know, quote unquote, outed for having a foot fetish. And there were these videos that surfaced of Rex fetishizing his wife in costume and otherwise. And like, it was front page news all over the world, like in Post. And Rex was devastated by it. And I tell the story in the book about how I came into his office one day and he was praying. And I was like, Rex, I didn't know you prayed. And he's like, well, I do now, Maddie. This is going to ruin my life. And I was like, Rex, no, it's not. I was like, you know what we're going to do next? What are we going to do? I said, like, we're going to go on Oprah. Oprah, as again, we're going to get a 5-book deal about how to maintain the love of your life after 20 plus years of marriage, that you still want to do videos about her feet. Like, damn, that's amazing. And he was laughing. 2 points of that story. You want to show up for people when they're, you know, if the train's coming, at least hold their hand and walk in front of it with them. But number two, when you own it, the power that is unleashed is incredible. So fast forward, he just chooses to own it, refuses to be defensive about it, also won't discuss it. And something amazing happens in the locker room. The players rally around him like, damn, Rex, you freaky. And also, like you're a human being. And he talks in a book about how they respected him because he owned it, but he also went through it. And we all have our things. Fast forward a decade later, I've been talking to Rex in a while, and I'm randomly watching like SportsCenter. I don't know how this came up, but something about someone's toe comes up and somebody's, you know, breaking their toe. And Rex goes, well, you know how I feel about feet. Like, so the point of the book, I don't know how we got here, by the way, but the point of the book is really to appropriate this idea of burn the boats, but also to demonstrate that, back to the original point about this fake arc on social media that I think does a disservice, to demonstrate that no matter what level you've summited, that you are still having to burn boats at every level. And here's why I think the social media can do such a disservice, especially the gurus, is by perpetuating that the stumbles are in the rearview mirror, that actually does a disservice to the person who's receiving the information, because they know the truth for them is it's not in the rearview mirror. I stumble every day. I can't implement this beautiful advice. Thank you, Mr. Guru. I'm trying to. And so this isn't a deliberate attempt to undermine the crap out of my legacy story. And the first page of the book is heartbreaking failure. And it didn't start out. I had to rewrite the book twice because it's supposed to start with a different moral. At first was about how I launched a $200 million SPAC in the pandemic. Yay me, sitting in this chair in my boxer shorts, raised $200 million. Everybody's going to be rich. And it fails. Lose millions of dollars and breaks my heart after 2 years of work, after I had double pneumonia during COVID, right? Okay. I started a TV show with Mark Burnett. You know, amazing. I'm going to have my own Shark Tank. It's called Business Hunters, number one producer in America. It's going to be on CNBC. We shoot 8 episodes. They cancel all their TV programs, including my show. That's how I started the book. And I was like, you know what? This is the point. The universe is saying, don't start with success. Model what failure really looks like and model what it means to extract value from failure rather than a bullshit Instagram post.
Did you ever read a book called The Body Keeps the Score?
I have never read it, but I am fascinated by it because that book, I don't even know who the author is. I know he's probably famous. I've never read it. And it's been on the New York Times bestseller for like 8 million weeks.
I am a former criminal prosecutor in the Bronx, SVU.
Are you really?
So, yeah.
That's amazing. Thank you. What are you talking about me? I'm talking about you. That's badass.
I appreciate you. Thank you very much.
Wait, where'd you go to law school?
Toro Law. I did it 4 years
ago. Oh, amazing. Out in Long Island. I grew up in, I did work in Huntington.
You're familiar.
Yeah. Wow. Prosecutor.
Yeah. That's not anymore. Deal. Now I'm corporate. So
are you? You sold out. I'm taking away all my praise. But you were saying body keeps the score.
Yeah. So The Body Keeps the Score is a fantastic book, and it really helped me in how I approach conversations with victims of domestic violence or people that had suffered from any kind of trauma. And, you know, you talk a lot about trauma and in some form or another, and you also talk a lot about presence. And one of the there's a couple points that you brought up that obviously the book holds a very dear place in my heart. I still open it up regularly, and it's.
Oh, thank you, man. Honestly, like, I still struggle with, like, should I keep pushing it? You know, should you just stop? And then I get the feedback from somebody that changes the trajectory of their life. But then sometimes I feel like the mere act of marketing it, like, I shouldn't have to market if it's good enough. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it takes care of itself. Yeah. And so one of the key lessons that really comes up is that no one heals in a straight line. And having that perspective, it's also like progress isn't expected to be linear. It's supposed to be this zig, this zag, and we lose sight of that because we're so busy trying to accomplish things that regressions, you know, we don't realize can still be springboards to help us achieve the thing that we're after. How has your success shaped your view of your trauma? Or any of the issues that you outlined earlier? I don't want to speak on your behalf because you've been through quite a lot where you drop out of high school, your teachers tell you you're pretty much worth nothing, what a shame, and you got a lot of reasons to doubt yourself because you're not following what the system was designed for, so the system forces you out of the system and you're kind of put on your own career trajectory that you go on to eventually go through law school and oh so much more. How has your success shaped your view of everything that you've been through?
I'm going to answer with what comes to mind right away and why I wrote the book. First of all, your career is amazing that you were a prosecutor in the Bronx. And so you could understand this point. I did a talk with students who are getting their GED in a homeless shelter. And as you know, how those students end up in a homeless shelter in a lot of cases, and a lot of them were being rejected by the parents because they came out. It's just like so sad. But I remember walking in the room thinking, how incredible that you are doing this. Despite what you're going through, that you're striving and surviving at the same time, which to me is always at the top of the hierarchy of admiration. It's for those who are surviving yet still aspiring, because life saps that from you often. Anyway, I show up in the room and I'm giving this talk, and I'm wearing my suit and I look well polished, manifest in a world as a wealthy, prominent white male. And I started saying, well, what do you think when you see me? And then one student's like, oh, where's your plane? And you're on Shark Tank, and oh, blah, blah, blah. And then I tell the story in more detail than I ever would in the book or publicly, the real, deeper. And one girl's sobbing in the back of the room, like crying, like, oh my God, like you've been where we are. And I was like, you, what you're doing is even much harder than what I had. At least I had a roof. And my point being, at that moment, I realized, what do we do with our authority? Because I came from nothing and I transcended, and I now represent this tremendous juxtaposition between a high school dropout and government cheese and running multiple NFL teams and being on TV, what's the point of that authority? Do I use that authority to self-aggrandize, to accumulate more wealth? Or do I use that authority to pull back the curtain on what it really looks like so that I can inspire that sobbing girl in the room to believe it is possible? Some version of this. And the only way I could make somebody feel it's possible is if I don't appear to be superhuman. So if I act like everything is reconciled, no one can meet me anywhere. And so my book was like, I know I'm going to use my authority, my power, my money, my prominence, my communication skills to ameliorate suffering. And the way I will do that is by convincing people that the die is not cast, by either their decisions or by the circumstances they were born into. But the only way that I could bridge the divide is to lower myself, because we're in a balkanized world. You see me, you're like, oh, white male, privilege, Shark Tank, I can't possibly relate to you. And so if I share the concurrent stumbles, then I can meet people where they are. And that has happened. It's amazing. Every day I wake up, somebody on LinkedIn somewhere connects with me who feels seen by the book, or feels like I held up a mirror because of some detail that I shared in that book. So it's a long way of saying, back to how do I relate, see my trauma, that it's very important to share that the trauma is unreconciled and just how hard it is to reconcile deeply ingrained trauma. I was living in that house and never had a friend over my home until the day my mother died when I was 26 years old. My entire life was a construct of fraud to conceal shame, of living in a roach motel on a chewed out mattress on the floor with the cigarette butts next to my head going into the ashtray in the morning, just trying to find a few with some left. And my mother literally died in squalor. And I leave that house like Clark Kent and change into a suit and become the press secretary of the mayor of New York. That's the same day, the same dirty bed, the same crazy life, the same empty bank account. And then I go become the press secretary of the mayor of New York at 26. My point is, I used to judge people that they hadn't gotten over it. Because I was like, whatever, I'm here. I got out of poverty. I managed 9/11. I'm fine. I don't need anyone. And then when life brought me to my knees, I was like, oh, you were just trying to outrun it. Like, and you didn't outrun it. And so it's a long way of saying the way I see my trauma now is a gift. I leave these wounds unhealed because I worry that if I were to cauterize them, that it would also entomb my empathy. And then if I leave everything a little fresh, if we start talking about the day my mother dies, you will see tears begin to go, because that is what enables me to bridge the divide. And so I've come to see my trauma not as a gift, but as an ongoing operation and as something that I should be honest about. The reason why I started this interview saying I don't sleep, because that's not healthy. And it's not like I'm an executive and I don't sleep. Something. No, because I go to sleep and it's Vietnam still. Some days it's better. Some days it's not. But some days it's a lot that just isn't. So I think that the greatest gift you can make is to be honest about how hard and how long these, you've seen some horrible things. I know you have, right? Like they take a long time to overcome. And and rather than beat myself up that I need to overcome them, I'm much more forgiving around mitigating them and working around them. I'm not a huge therapy person where I'm like, I got to extinguish this. I'm like, I don't know, maybe I got to live with it. Is more the point. When people are like, let's talk about running sports teams, I'm like, boring. Let's talk about trauma. Let's talk about shame and stigma and failure. These are the topics I enjoy.
Same. And we've had some executives and have some executive sports teams coming on, definitely ones we're excited about. And I just feel that these topics and this podcast is largely about managing your mindset. And part of that is because for the longest time, whenever I'd get on stage or in front of a jury or in court, whatever it was, I'd get these butterflies, this like performance anxiety that I wanted to do it. I wanted to be great, but these things were holding me back. So in over 100 episodes, I've had the pleasure and privilege to sit across from people like yourself and learn how to manage emotions, compartmentalize. And on that note, you mentioned 9/11. And when I was in law school, I had the opportunity to meet a judge who was one of the attorneys of the New York State Department when it was first formed after 9/11. And that judge ended up being an incredible mentor to me over the course of a couple of years during law school. It was one of the reasons that I went to go become a prosecutor. And so I had him on the podcast. It was one of like the first 30 episodes. And so I asked him about the concept of compartmentalization. And especially in a moment like that where, you know, the New York State Department had just been formed after 9/11. And he equated it to flying the plane and building it in the air at the same time. I'm curious from your perspective, when it comes to managing your emotions when you have to perform, how do you compartmentalize?
There context. I wonder what agency he was talking about. But I was on the ground too. First employee of the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, and we're just the you know third, first, second. We all started at the same time of this new agency charged with rebuilding the World Trade Center. So I called the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, so I could relate. How do I deal with compartmentalization? How do I see it? So I always say this, the one of the gifts of trauma is pattern recognition because you spend so much time hyper aroused scanning your environment for danger that you do become very intuitive at picking up threats, negative, but opportunities, positive. And if you can marry that with courage of conviction, you can act on opportunity before the tipping point of evidence. And that's where money is made. Pattern recognition plus the courage to act on opportunity before the tipping point is where you make money. So that is one of the gifts that I love talking about, because we sort of, you don't want to become a victim, right? Never want to be a victim. So you have to figure out, okay, where's the opportunity? And so a second gift, consequence, both of trauma, is the ability to disassociate or compartmentalize. And so I do think it is a gift. When I was there on 9/11, I do feel like I was the right person for the right time. My mother had just died only a few months prior to, and now I am the press secretary to the mayor of New York and the worst terrorist attack in history. And I brought every single prime minister, president on earth to the site so they couldn't deny the carnage. And so we could use their military bases for the counterattack. And so I brought Vladimir Putin to the site, literally, like crazy as that is. And so anyway, so wow. That's an example when compartmentalization is great. And a lot of times, in order for me to compartmentalize, I do allow myself to take on a third person identity. I talk in the book about how talking to yourself in the third person is actually very effective. And studies show that when you say to yourself, I got this, doesn't work. When you say to yourself, you know, Matt, you've got this, it's like a superego authority who's on your side. And studies show that language matters. And so I do compartmentalize. I think compartmental is important. And I do insert like a superego for self-talk when I'm in those situations. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, honestly, if I'm so disassociated, I'll ask somebody else, what would it be like if I walked in the room in this circumstances and were to give, help me see me so I can assume the role, right? Where compartmentalization can be dangerous is when it masks unresolved pain or issues you're struggling with. And so that is something I have had to work with, it because I did become very disassociated all those years under such duress that, again, you start to seek out situations where they feed your adrenaline so you could feel, you know, you want to be moved. You become an adrenaline junkie. But regulating your emotions is a huge key to success. And people who cannot regulate their emotions professionally end up having a ceiling on their career.
How can someone start to harness their communicative skills so they could become better at expressing themselves, understanding themselves, and taking their skill set up a level?
Great question. Well, I'll go back in time. When I was in college, I was a terrible communicator and had like a weird vocal tic, and I would go like all the time, and felt very, so number one, there's methods to everything and organizing. And I totally believe in classes, especially in this area. Like there's certain, you know, I'm always skeptical when people say I'm a life learner. I said, you'd rather be a lifelong doer, you know, two parts doing, one part learning. But when it comes to communications, you actually can learn, because communication begins with the ability to organize your thoughts in a sequence, to unpack them in a way that it's meant to be assimilated. So one, you got to learn that craft. And there are certain hacks that I learned when I was in college. I became president of the speech and debate team. And then two, you have to be comfortable sitting with yourself to be a good communicator. And it took me a long time. You have to be comfortable not trying to fill every void so that you can let the words sit. And that oftentimes when people aren't comfortable communicating, it actually underscores something that's unreconciled in themselves. They don't feel comfortable being seen or scrutinized or looked at. And so I would argue that if it's hard for you to show up in a room or speak, you're ill at ease with something about either your message or being seen. And you should attack that and meditate. Like, why? What's the big deal? What are the stakes? Who cares? I believe in what I'm saying. And so I have to say, ever since I did the book, I've never felt a closer connection between how I show up in the world versus what I was concealing on the inside. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So much of what I would be forced to talk about would be stuff I just don't care about, because it's like, oh, you're a big executive and you run NFL teams. Tell me about the draft. I'm like, I don't want to talk about the draft. I want to talk about imposter syndrome. And now I wrote this book, gone down the rabbit hole, and now people only want to talk to me about the stuff that I want to talk about. So what's interesting is when you start communicating and sharing your truth, you'll find the world will meet you where you wish to manifest. That's amazing. Like, I've honestly never felt more at ease publicly than I do now. And that's after sharing the most embarrassing stuff. Isn't that interesting?
Become a magnet.
Yeah. And I've got nothing left to share mostly. And two, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not concealing things but I forced the conversation about things I want to talk about. So, but my first piece of advice, so anybody out there finds it hard, have you really invested in learning the craft? Because I'll give you one little tactic I use. And anyone out there is listening who has to give a speech can borrow this tactic. No matter what audience I'm in, I will attempt to find something to talk about that just happened or something that's visible in the room that is either funny or compelling or completely off topic. And what that demonstrates subconsciously to the audience is this is not a canned speech. And you are so damn comfortable that you're willing to break form. So I remember when I had to speak at Central Park in front of 60,000 people after Prince Harry had spoken. And I was announcing a program on behalf of Pope Francis and this group called the Global Solidarity Fund to raise $100 million for migrants and immigrants. And I'm like, there was a teleprompter. I had 60 seconds. And I remember I'm about to go upstage with my son. It was such a great moment. And I'm like, I think I'm going to wing it. And he's like, Dad, you cannot. There's a teleprompter there. I'm like, no, I think I'm going to wing it because if I need, I have 60 seconds to make these people feel what I feel. And he's like, well, what are you going to say? And I was like, and then the woman comes up to me. She's like, sir, you have 60 seconds. Please be tight. Like we're running behind. They always do that. Right. I'm like, yeah, sure. No problem. This is a true story. I was like, I have two things to do here. I have to grab this audience and I have to show my son what it looks like when you take risks, you know, and for a good cause. And I'm walking up the steps and I'm like, I actually don't know what I'm going to do or say. And I see the teleprompter and 60,000 people, and it's being broadcast to a billion people around the world. And as I walk up the steps, it comes to me and I'm like, I know what I'm going to say. And I get up there and I say to the crowd, I say, anyone here from New York? And I'm like, yeah, I'm like, I'm from New York. And I'm like, yeah, cool. And I was like, actually, you see all these buildings behind you? And it's on Central Park. So it's all the tall 60,000 people turn around. And I said, right. And I go, yeah, I didn't live in those buildings. I grew up in Queens in a Roach Motel. And I start, and everyone starts laughing. And now I have their attention for 60 seconds. And it was such an amazing moment. And so I share that for a variety of reasons. What happens when you take risks with public communication? But also I moved those people and I made them care. And there are nuns and on the front line of terrible things in Ethiopia. They were my motivation to crush that speech. Like, let me transmit the power of their message. And also I'm not a good Catholic. So I was like, this will be my penance. But so back to tactics. Whenever you're giving a speech, find something to talk about that's spontaneous and impromptu that will earn the respect of the audience before you go into your prepared remarks. And number two, never use prepared remarks. I will never ever read a speech, no matter what the stakes are. I will internalize the speech and then I will always wing it. And the way I do that is structure. You have your structural points, you have the words that you'll key off of, and then you speak from the heart. Sorry to take this on so long. I've never talked about this before publicly about communications and how to hack it. So that's one little tip.
I love it. I think it's so important to hear from someone that could get up on those stages, handle their nerves, and deliver a message at a high clip with purpose, intention, charisma, and actually have people resonate with it, especially if they're unfamiliar with who you are and it's nationally broadcast. It's a prime example, so it's welcomed.
No, it's a good point. Like, nobody in there cared. So it's like, how am I going to... And then also the good part is step in the audience. She was like, would I care? I was like, I wouldn't care. Who the hell are you? You're not like a Prince Harry. You know, like, but anyway, good topic.
So I'd be a bit remiss if I didn't ask, and it's not about the sports teams.
No, we could talk about that, by the way. I'm just telling you what I like to talk about.
No, honestly, like, I just find, all due respect to sports and everything, I'm just kind of in a season of life right now where, like, there's just not that same affinity for what sports used to mean to me. I'll still, you know, tune in here and there, big games, but I'm really just in a season of taking action and doing things, and for better or worse, sports is kind of a distraction right now. But the people that make those things happen, obviously, kudos to them. So I'd be a bit remiss if I didn't ask, like, Guest Shark or the co-founder of RSC Ventures about his decision-making framework around investments at a high level, service level. Maybe you could share some variables or factors that you consider that help you make informed decisions when taking on an investment.
Of course, I love talking about investing. And let me separate it into different buckets. Let's set aside venture investing for the time being. Let's just talk about building companies. So when it's such a cliche, but it's so true. You do bet on the jockey. And I just hate that cliches are true because they're so cliche. But the what I've learned, the lesson I've learned the hard way and had to repeat it a couple of times because I just don't, you don't want to accept it, is I used to think that the power of an idea or the radical nature of an idea could eclipse a weak founder. And even though my instinct and pattern recognition would tell me that the person I'm talking to doesn't have what it takes, you can't change that person because they're the advocate of it, right? They're the representative on this earth for that idea. And then when you see the idea, you're like, damn, that's a really good idea. And when I've acted, it always ends up a failure. And I always end up having to deal with the fact that the person who brought the idea forward is not capable of executing it. Now, if they over-index for self-awareness, it gives you a shot because they could come to that conclusion themselves and we could change. So I'm always looking for people who were put on this earth to manifest this idea and frankly have what it takes, way more important than the nuance of the idea, because winners iterate. Winners always iterate through their problems. And so what do I look for most when I want to do a deal? I look for somebody when I leave them, say, like, they'll just figure it out. When I find somebody with every interaction, and I'm like, damn, they'll just figure it out, or damn, I would love them to work for me because they'll just figure out whatever I'm dealing with. Those people are at the top of somebody you want to back because it scales. You don't have to intervene or tell them what they're doing wrong because they'll just figure it out and they'll make those decisions. So that's number one. I bet on the jockey. Number two, I look for people who will just figure out. Number three, I want ideas that are large enough to justify the pain of backing something or someone. Every time I write a check, it's like I'm signing up for a new job. No matter what I talk myself into in the beginning about how great it's going to be, it always ends up being a job. So I think people focus too little on opportunity cost and too much on opportunity. I put more energy on opportunity cost because I'm always trying to forecast future Matt 3 years later to be like, in 3 years, is this going to be worth my time? And I think most people are so excited about an opportunity, they don't ask that question and they shortchange the future version of themselves that will have been the benefit of compounding. You have more money, you have more experience, you have less time. I think the reason why people get very dissatisfied with their decisions or their company or their life is because they didn't put enough energy on that. So I'm always saying, is this going to be worth my time? On the public market side, I love the public markets as a microcosm for pattern recognition because I didn't realize that the Wall Street is very inefficient. I would have presumed that since everyone is operating on the same data, which is why the SEC passed those rules back in 1933, forget it, for the Securities Exchange Act was 31 or 33. But anyway, that it's meant to level the playing field. And the playing field is largely leveled because we have tons of information and white collar prosecution around insider information. And then what I realize is that's actually not what actually determines the outcome of success financially when it comes to Wall Street. It's actually insight asymmetry, not information asymmetry. What are your insights? And so I'll give you an example. When I first came across Mounjaro, and actually a medical context, because my blood pressure was like 170 over 110, I was so overweight. And I realized how transformative it's going to be. I'm like, wow, this is going to transform society. It's going to give people their life back. It's going to crush sugary snacks. You know, it's like, and I began to act on that insight via the stock market long before that became conventional wisdom. But if I had waited for the numbers to come out about how many people are using it and, you know, the studies that came out eventually showing how it brings down your blood pressure, like all these other things, and or if I had waited to short Pepsi until it was clear that Pepsi was in trouble. So what I would say to anyone listening is all of us have insights that we can glean from our experiences all around us in our day-to-day, where we can then monetize those insights. But where we fall short is we wait for somebody else to validate them. We wait for it to become conventional wisdom to act, and by then it is too late. And so where I love public markets, for anyone listening, it's a training ground for you to build confidence in your insights. I'll give you one right now for fun. We can test whether this proves to be true, which is going to suck if it isn't. You know, Apple has done a terrible job, at least optically, embracing AI. The stock has been beaten up. Number one biggest company in the world is down year to date, while you and I are doing this interview, I think 11%. And it has done nothing over the last year while Nvidia has run and, you know, and whatnot, right? So now, if you're Apple, you control my relationship with information through my phone that I check 8 million times a day. When I talk to Siri, it's like talking to Atari. I don't know if you remember Atari when you were a kid. Like it is unbelievable. I put a meme out the other day of Miami Vice when they were on the phone, like this big clunky thing. That's Siri, right? How long is Apple going to let that be the case? You think Apple's going to go down without a fight when they're the one who has the direct relationship? Imagine how much I'd be using ChatGPT right now if it was an easy interface with mobile. So what's all that add up to? I believe Apple is going to make a hard play this summer to demonstrate that they are not going to be left behind by the AI. And all Apple has to do is sneeze the word AI for the stock to run. So I have made a bet using call spreads, which I love derivatives, to bet on Apple, because I think that's coming now. That's just an insight. And so I'm sharing this with the listeners to say, you have your own insights about what you think is great. You tried Shake Shack for the first time. And you're like, damn, that cheeseburger's killer. So I think we discount our own insights because we think it's more complicated than that. And when you begin to get involved with Wall Street, you realize, one, it's not that complicated. Two, it's not like these people know so much better than you do. Three, it's all a hustle. It's all about just trying to make fees, to be honest with you. And like, that is the reality, not to be all Oliver Stoney on you, but it's true. So I'm just giving you some insights into my overall investing approach, private equity. But I think public markets are a great training ground for people to learn. Last point, really passionate about this. Shorting anything in life is a fool's game, because the same way in the casino, there's a game called Wheel of Fortune, the casino where you put $5 down on five, whatever. The casino edge on that is 11%. If you look at the Wall Street going back to 1957 to 2003, the annualized rate of return is 10.26%. So the casino has the odds in Wheel of Fortune, and in Wall Street, the S&P has the edge. It will go up over time. So why are you betting on red when black is going to win over the long arc? So for those who think they could time it and short this stock, short that, you're honestly better of trying to identify macro trends with really good tailwinds and get behind those tailwinds, like GLP-1 drugs, like NVIDIA chips. And that's where I believe that diversification is the enemy of wealth creation. At any one time, I only own like four stocks. All my money is in those things. And I find different ways to go ahead and press them and play them and learn from them. And we're taught to play it safe by diversifying. And when you diversify your conviction, you end up with a whole pile of nothing, of mediocrity.
That was powerful.
Thank you. I just figured somebody out there's listening. Let's jump it all out while it's in my head. And, now, of course, somebody's like, Matt, Apple tanked after you get that. By the way, that is possible. That's why I said four, not one.
Like, well, that's right. I mean, I'd bet on Apple any day.
Yeah, like, I mean, Lily is LLY is my passion, where I put a lot of energy, because it's the owners of Mounjaro, which is the superior one at the moment. And it's like an ETF because it has a new Alzheimer's drug coming, and lots of different ways to win. I love betting on big macro stocks so that you're a little bit more insulated from a black swan event. If people, you know, play meme stocks or these little companies, like, you can get decimated. I love playing big large cap companies with strong tailwinds, and then I play them every which way. I sell puts, I buy call spreads, I own the equity. I'm all in on those ideas.
I can't wait to listen back to this. Honestly, so I feel fun. Like that's what's going to happen.
No, this is a fun interview.
Not release this portion of the episode. No, I'm kidding.
Thanks for taking me. Plus, your hair is like amazing. Like, honestly, your hair, I mean, you're in your 40s, but I believe, because you said you were at law school.
34.
34? Oh, I thought you were in law school at around 9/11. Is that right?
No. My mentor was.
Oh, got it. Okay, got it. I was like, damn, how does this guy have that wavy hair?
Listen, hopefully I still have it in my 40s. I appreciate the time today. This has been so immense. I'm really super grateful. Please let the audience know where they can keep up with your journey.
Well, thank you for your time. It's an amazing interview. So we got some great golden nuggets in there. Play it back if you've listened to it, especially on investing and whatnot. So I'm on a mission with the book to reach people. Hopefully I can convince you that the die is never cast. And if you read the book, you'll find something in there that you'll connect with. But I have to sustain my effort every day. One, I'm embarrassed by the act of promoting it. Two, I want to move on with my life. And then three, nothing makes me happier. than those DMs. So if you read the book and it had an impact, please DM me and let me know. And please write a review so we can reach more people, because that means I'll do it one more day and I won't capitulate. So thanks for having me and thanks for listening.
My pleasure. Until the next one.